From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it. You can do it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please know how thankful we are for your support. Now, if you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
We got money that says in God we trust, but this nation stopped trusting God a long time ago. If we have turned against God as a nation, then God's going to do something about it at some point.
Yeah, that's right.
After 4 years of disrespect and outright dismissal, the leaders of our nation are again recognizing the significant numbers of secular and atheist Americans among us. The fact that this even needs saying is testimony to how skewed things had gotten in this country. After a first formal meeting between White House officials and activists defending the rights and interests of non-religious persons, I'm looking forward to a briefing from Debbie Allen, Executive Director of the Secular Coalition for America.
The One America movement is making a space for people to be able to disagree and still live together and still know that we have more things that we agree upon, more things that are like about us than are different.
While most Americans would not call themselves extremists, the rhetoric in many quarters of our public discourse continues to be destructively extreme. Methodically developing and deploying strategies to counter what they call toxic polarization in our country is the One America movement this week. We'll get an update from Movement President and CEO Andrew Hanauer. But first,
does the court saying they're taking this case necessarily mean they're going to use this case to overturn Roe?
No, but I think the court's taking this case signals that they're interested, if not in getting rid of Roe altogether, at least in rethinking viability as the point at which states can ban abortions. And that would be almost as significant as overturning Roe itself.
The previous administration may be gone, but the decisions it made continue to echo throughout our government. Perhaps nowhere is that more stark than in the makeup of the Supreme Court, where the blatant obstruction of a constitutionally mandated appointment by Barack Obama was followed by three far-right appointments in a single presidential term. And now come cases that many have feared this SCOTUS lineup was designed to address in ways most Americans can't even imagine. For a look at this daunting scenario, I'm pleased to welcome author and attorney Dr. Jay Michelson back to State of Belief Radio. Jay, it's good to have you with us again.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Let's start with the situation you wrote compellingly about this week in the Daily Beast. The headline reads, "This case will mark the beginning of the end for Roe v. Wade." What's the case?
So this is a case challenging a Mississippi abortion law, which effectively bans abortion after 15 weeks, which is an advance from where Roe versus Wade had it. Basically, it sort of slides the goalposts and makes it just that much harder to get an abortion. And the only real question in the case is whether the Supreme Court will allow a little restriction, a lot of restriction, or actually just throw out Roe versus Wade entirely.
Hmm. How did this case make it all the way to the Supreme Court?
Well, this case is designed to make it all the way to the Supreme Court. In fact, a number of states are kind of falling all over each other, trying to get a case that goes to the Supreme Court to test Roe versus Wade, since we know that three of the court's six conservatives were specifically vetted to overturn Roe versus Wade. I mean, this is what they were created for. This is why they came up through the system and why they were suggested by the Federalist Society and why they were appointed by Donald Trump. So the idea of these laws is just blatantly challenge Roe versus Wade. So in this case, the lower court opinion said, well, this is obviously unconstitutional. This is clearly against Roe versus Wade. And that's the whole point. The point was to make it as easy as possible to lose at the district court level and then the circuit court level so they could get right to the Supreme Court. And there's another law that just got passed out of Texas that's very similar.
Yeah. Jay, how much of this is about religious dogma and how much of it is science and medicine?
Oh, 100 to 0. There is certainly no science or medicine, especially around the 15-week line. I mean, what the difference is between 15, I wrote in my Daily Beast article, the only significance of 15 is that it's less than 24, which is the Roe versus Wade number, and more than zero. There's no scientific basis for this whatsoever. This is just politics. It's no secret that Donald Trump won the election in 2016 because of the support of the hard right, the religious right, so-called religious right. And this is payback. And they knew exactly why they were voting for him. And this was one of the main reasons. And so this is entirely, whether you want to call it religion or politics, this is catering to a part of the Republican base.
The justices have just agreed to hear this case, but a ruling is expected in October. Is that right?
No, they'll hear the case in October. So I would expect it depends how long they want to kind of sit on it. And it's actually very politically relevant. If this were, if this is one of the first cases that the court hears in its October term, it could be decided in December, January, or February, let's say, of 21-22. Mm. That would make it a pretty significant election issue because that will give, assuming Roe is cut back, that will give all of so-called red states the opportunity to really restrict abortion. And so then that becomes much more of a political issue for the 2022 election. Mm. On the other hand, it could actually go as late as a year from now. We may not have a ruling in this case for a year, in which case, we'll see how that affects the political process.
Hmm. I just have to ask you this. Has Amy Coney Barrett done anything of note yet that would confirm the well-founded fears of her critics? Or is there maybe some evidence that she may be more than just an ideologue?
I don't think there's that much evidence either way. It's been interesting. This term has been a relatively boring term for the Supreme Court, although there's one major religion case that's still to be decided, the Fulton case about whether adoption agencies can turn away all kinds of people, LGBT people, but also people who aren't religious or aren't religious in the right way. I expect that will be the first case really where we'll see the court's conservative religious side flex its muscles. The only cases we've really seen so far have been on the pandemic, where the court, in a run of opinions, has not only allowed all kinds of exemptions, all kinds of exemptions to COVID safety regulations for churches, they've kind of gone out of their way, led by Justice Gorsuch, to kind of add language about how religious claims are more important than any other kind of claim because they're constitutional. That's actually a very important doctrine that the court has never adopted before. That would certainly mean the Fulton case, I think, is already open and shut about adoption, but that would certainly mean impacts on Roe versus Wade as well. But I think, remember that Justice Barrett is the most junior justice on the court, so she's not going to get a lot of opportunities to write opinions in these high-profile cases. She certainly voted with the conservative majority all of the time, just like she did before she was appointed, by the way, 100% taking kind of the conservative substantive line on cases. But I don't think we've really seen yet any evidence one way or the other. We knew her questions at oral argument are very sharp, are very pointed. She's obviously very intelligent. We knew that going in. This is not someone who's just kind of a placeholder. I mean, she's really a strong legal thinker. But She's also been 100% conservative so far.
Well, Jay, the really good piece that you wrote this last week makes the reader think that you think it's going to be up there and be shot down. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that Roe is going to be severely limited by this case. The question is how severely. And again, that could range from totally overturning the law and allowing all abortion restrictions, including total bans. It could be chipping away. Be a little bit technical about what the standard is for chipping away at Roe. So there's kind of a range of, for pro-choice people, a range of bad news. And we won't know for some time which of those is chosen. But I'd be extremely surprised if this case leaves current law in place the way it is now.
How do you think it's going to be debated?
This is going to be a constitutional argument. And, you know, for folks who follow this issue closely, they might know this, but others might not. You know, the abortion right hinges it doesn't have the strongest textual foundation. Obviously, there's nothing in the Constitution which says that women have the right to control their own bodies. Mm-hmm. But that principle that women as a subset of people have the right to control their own bodies in this democracy is seen to be kind of embedded in the Constitution and in the Bill of Rights. But there's no sentence which says women have the right to control their own bodies. And so the foundation for the abortion right is what's sometimes called the right to privacy. We might really think of it as the right to bodily integrity. It's the right that I, as a human being, have not given my body over to the state to be regulated however the state feels like doing it. To me, that's a very clear principle, but that's not something that's written in the text of the Constitution. And so the people who are originalists or textualists who take a very sort of narrow, like if it's not written in the text of the Constitution, it's not a constitutional right, you know, Roe is very vulnerable. So I would not expect, it'll be one of those weird cases where everyone on one side of the argument is sort of secretly motivated by a religious teaching or pleasing a religious constituency. But what we're talking about on the surface is this matter of constitutional theory.
I see. What are you keeping your eyes on related to religious liberty, that even if it's not related to Roe v. Wade?
Well, the Fulton case, the adoption case, that is the case of the year for religion. It is almost certainly going to go in the pro-religious, again, pro-right-wing religious, anti-LGBT and anti-church state separation way. And again, a little bit like the Mississippi abortion case, it's a question of how much. So will this be a narrow exemption for this particular provider of adoption and foster care services? Will it be something broader? I suspect it will be extremely broad. If you look at particularly Justice Gorsuch, but also Justice Barrett and Justice Thomas and Justice Alito, I mean, that's four votes of people who have gone on record as saying, you know, a religious claim basically trumps every other kind of claim. And that means a blanket constitutional religious exemption for everything. So if I have a race non-discrimination law, but I have a racist belief in my understanding of religion, I could claim that my racist religious belief trumps not only that law, but other constitutional claims as well. So I should be able to discriminate on the basis of race if I have a religious reason. That's the logic. And I think it's maybe a coin toss. We don't know if Fulton is going to come out that way. I'm sure I'll be back on the program when it does come out, because this would be a very important case. But it might. And that would really be an earthquake for how any religious claim is handled. You know, you and I have been following this issue now for going on 10 years,
yeah.
And it's piecemeal. So this state has a religious exemption, or this place has a religious exemption. But if this Fulton case goes in the extreme way, there won't need to be religious exemptions, because that's going to be found right in the Constitution. Of course, it's ironic that the same justices who will invent this whole set of rights in one case are saying that, well, if it's not written down in the case of Roe versus Wade, it doesn't exist. But that being that as it may, I mean, that's the major religion case. It should be the biggest religious liberty case since Hobby Lobby. And it could come out next week. We don't know. Probably they're saving it for toward the end of June, as they often do. But sometime in the next few weeks, it will come down.
What's a citizen to do at this point? Because it seems to me now, everybody's excited because the court has said we're going to rule on this. It's in the hands of the court. They're the only ones that can do anything at this point, regardless of what everyone else is saying. Do you see it that way, or is there any give and take that might change during the whole process?
No, it's too late. It's too late for this right. It's too late for this court. And it's too late for this case. This is part of what's challenging about this issue. People's eyes glazed over when, you know, we talk about Supreme Court nominees, certainly other court nominees, because it's, you know, it's talked about at the hearings, but it nothing really happens. So the justice is put on the court, is seated, and then we all move on to other things. You know, and then a year or two later, some case like this comes along. And all of a sudden, people are getting angry, but it's too late to get angry. So, but I'm glad that you mentioned that, because as I actually want to throw in a little optimistic note here.
Good.
So my assumption is this case is going to go badly for the pro-choice side, and that many states are going to enact very significant abortion restrictions, if not total bans, very soon, within a year. Hmm. That is actually not what a large majority of Americans support. It's a little tricky because Americans say about 80% of Americans say that Roe versus Wade should be left alone. That's an astonishing number, right? That means that includes about 60% of Republicans, right? So that's a huge number. It's tricky because most people don't really know what Roe versus Wade really says. And so they say, well, but some restrictions should be allowed. So it's not really clear what that means. But there's certainly a clear pro-choice majority for the core right that women have to control their own body, yeah. Right? It's not a close case. So this is a minority opinion that the Supreme Court is going to impose on the United States. And when these state legislatures start passing these abortion restrictions, then it'll be time for citizens to do something, right? It'll be time to flip as many of those state houses as possible. It'll be time for this to be the number one issue for many voters, not just one among many. And it'll be a time to really look at this in the Congress as well, right? I mean, if we didn't have the kind of compromised confirmation processes that we had for these three Trump appointees, right? Remember, all three are there under a shadow, right? Justice Gorsuch, his seat belonged to Merrick Garland. Justice Kavanaugh, unaddressed sexual assault and rape allegations with more evidence that came out after his hearings that made it seem even more likely that Dr. Blasey Ford was telling the truth. And Justice Barrett, who was rushed in the election, even though the same Senate had just said, the same people said a few years ago, no, we have to wait a whole year. So all three of these have kind of a cloud over them, and they are going to be in the majority of this decision. And so it's time to really connect the dots. So, yes, it's too late for a citizen to do anything about this case, but it's not too late to make sure that the next one doesn't happen. And the way to do that is to have state legislatures that reflect people, and to remove these outrageous voting restrictions, which continue to have been passed in the last several months, so that we can actually have free and fair elections, and make this an issue that matters in the 2022 congressional midterms. This should be, if the timing goes the way I think it will go, this should be one of the major issues next year, and that's when it's time to get involved.
Dr. Jay Michelson is an author, an attorney, and an activist. He's also a rabbi and a meditation teacher, who balances all of these roles in a wise and graceful way, still finding time to always answer when we call at State of Belief. Jay Michelson's books include God versus Gay, The Religious Case for Equality, and Enlightenment by Trial and Error, 10 Years on the Slippery Slopes of Jewish Spirituality, Postmodern Buddhism, and Other Mystical Heresies. Jay, we just are very grateful. Thank you.
That's very kind. It's my pleasure.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Up next, the Biden White House opens up dialogue with secular activists. We'll get a briefing from Debbie Allen, who heads up the Secular Coalition for America. And later, an update on the inspiring work of the One America movement with Andrew Hanauer. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. During the White House term of the previous president, we'd gotten accustomed to images of extreme political religious right figures laying hands on the leader of the free world, or marching across megachurch stages declaring the Oval Office to be holy ground. Well, okay, I won't say accustomed, maybe grown numb to is a better way to put it. In any case, the nonstop affirmation of one kind of fundamentalist prosperity gospel nationalistic Christianity was uncomfortable enough for most Americans of faith who do not subscribe to this dogmatic authoritarian version of their religion. How much more alienating, then, were these years for the many millions who identify as atheist, as humanist, as secular? But with new national leadership comes renewed respect for the awesome diversity that comprises our society. And so it is no surprise that a proudly Catholic president has made sure his administration is reaching out to Americans slighted by recent imbalances which led this past week to a meeting between White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships and leaders of prominent secular groups in this country. For a readout of this important step forward, I'm really happy to be joined by Debbie Allen, Executive Director of the Secular Coalition for America. Debbie, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here and to share what we've been doing.
Good, good. Well, what a welcome change, right? I still find it hard to believe how narrowly focused the previous White House was in the 21st century on one small slice of the Americans' values pie.
Yes, yes. We certainly saw a lot of white Christian nationalism flowering in full glory in the public square, and never so clearly than on January 6th recently. And we've been watching with some horror, and maybe I should back up and say we've also been watching with some gratitude that previous administrations have started including and being inclusive of people of no faith, as well as people of diverse faiths. So we are trying always to move towards a greater pluralism. And this previous administration seem to be taking away all the gains from the Obama-Biden administration. You may remember that nuns, people with no religious affiliation, were even called out during Obama's inaugural address. And we about fell off our chairs or our couches at home. And I can only imagine how exciting it would have been to be here in the nation's capital hearing that kind of language for the very first time.
Well, I tell you, I was tickled to death to hear that you were having a meeting in the White House or from the White House.
I had had some familiarity with Josh Dixon, who's the deputy director. He was very welcoming to the humanist community. We even had a progressive humanist group gathered to be humanists for Biden, and we got to know Josh at that time. We're familiar with Director Rogers' work because she did very well in the Obama administration. I consider her a real scholar and a real friend to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I mean, I think she embodies that in everything she does. So I have tremendous respect, and actually a person of no faith has faith in other people. And I do have faith in the people that are directing that office. However, when you look at what we do, the Secular Coalition for America, where we're looking to increase the visibility and respect for non-theists, specifically atheists, agnostics, humanists, freethinkers, et cetera, we become very concerned when we have White House offices called faith-based initiatives. Right. Now, so our request was that they rescind the executive order from the Trump era to continue such an office. But since they have that office, we want to be included. And we are emboldened by the fact that they call themselves faith-based and neighborhood partnerships. In other words, we fit in. Their fact sheet also reminds us what they intend to do. And I wanted to just read something from their fact sheet because it meant a lot to us. The partnership's office initial work will include collaborating with civil society to address the COVID-19 pandemic, boost economic recovery, combat systemic racism, increase opportunity and mobility for historically disadvantaged communities, and strengthen pluralism. The office will also support agency partnerships that advance the United States government's diplomatic, international development, and humanitarian work around the world. All of this work will be done in ways that respect cherished constitutional guarantees. Now, that last line, which they also underscore later on in the fact sheet, that also mentions secular humanists by name, which is unusual in any kind of executive mm-hmm. order, that together we can serve America and one another and strengthen our country. And so we are looking at this as a promise from this office about how they are going to engage secular organizations and that they are going to treat equally and fairly the religious and the non-religious nonprofits that are intending to help guide policies and help our neighbors in need.
Debbie, just so you know, since 1999, I had been arguing that we did not need a faith-based office in the White House, and I probably said that so many times I couldn't even count them before congressional committees and other places. And I always have hoped that that would change, but it hasn't changed, but at least we are seeing some openness in what you just read. I'm mm-hmm. curious, what were some of the issues raised by you and your partners in that meeting?
First of all, we thank the administration for things that had happened already by executive order and that have been passed as legislation, at least in the House. So certain things that are our priorities that we discussed are the Do No Harm Act, the Scientific Integrity Act, the No Ban Act, which is, you know, moving along, the Stop Female Genital Mutilation Act, Women's Health Protection Act. We named several areas in which people of no faith or the wrong faith are being discriminated against when applying for receiving public services or benefits. So we mentioned several things where they might lend a friendly voice to the conversation to the Biden-Harris administration. And we also suggested that they take a look at the Small Business Association's loans during the PPP program. Mm-hmm. Millions and millions of dollars were given to religious organizations, and those organizations do not have the same reporting requirements. So we become concerned when taxpayers' monies go off to religious organizations without accountability. Mm-hmm. And we need more eyes on that because some of that money can be used improperly and be, you know, can go underground and fund political candidates, which is against the IRS rules. So we're attending weekly meetings of this office. And I will say that that's one of the best things about them so far is they are having weekly meetings on Thursdays at noon. Anybody but can go. I don't believe they allow reporters, but that's only because they say, are you a reporter? Maybe they'll let you come, but you have restrictions. But anyway, they're keeping in touch with their partners, their mm-hmm. religious partners, their secular partners. So we kind of know what's happening. And members of my coalition, we have 19 member organizations in our coalition, and some of us from every organization are on every call sort of watching how it's going. Uh-huh. And we are mindful and, you know, a little bit suspicious there's going to be a slip here and there. and we're going to disagree with how monies might be granted. Mm-hmm. But we need to be at that table because Absolutely. The secular community deserves to receive some of these funds because they too are good neighbors and are helping others in their communities.
What would you say was your takeaway feeling from that first meeting? What was it your sense that the White House recognizes both the potential for partnering with you and the need to undo some of the damage that has been done in previous years?
Yes, I do think we have more that we agree about than we disagree about. And that is partly because this is a more progressive administration. Yeah. And people that are non-religious overall tend to be also more progressive in their social values. Mm-hmm. So we feel some common, right off the bat, we feel some common understandings about what should or should not happen. Like people should not be denied coming into the United States just because they're Muslim yeah. or from Africa. That just shouldn't happen. So we're all in agreement about that. One of the things that came out of the meeting that was important to me was we mentioned that our community is discriminated against. Almost 50% of atheists find themselves hiding in their lives. 30% conceal it from their family. 44% don't identify at work. 43% at school. Well, the reason you hide is when you're ashamed, and you're ashamed when you get bullied or discriminated against. So that's the nature of the everyday experience for most atheists. And another third report negative experiences in the workplace. So those are important issues to us, and we weren't necessarily focused on those, but their office, the White House office, is concerned about discrimination against religious people and non-religious people all over the world, and including in the United States. Yeah. So they actually asked us for our data, and we have been collecting it for many years, and we do have things that we can report. And I think this might be enlightening. Mm-hmm. to them, because yeah. sometimes, like if half of your population is in hiding, you don't understand how broad a community is. Right now, people that are unaffiliated with religion and or atheists represent about 26% of the people. And I think where this becomes really important is when Congress members go back to their home districts and start praying or proselytizing or suggesting that good Christian people will do X, Y, and Z, they better be familiar with the religious demographics in their district. Mm-hmm. And they need to understand that, especially more liberal progressive Democrats need to understand how many of them are actually non-believers and are being excluded. So
let's focus for a minute here just on the secular coalition. What are the top priorities for the coalition and its partners in the coming months?
Well, we do have our secular agenda, and we're trying to meet with as many legislators as possible. They have been very busy with lots of things, but we can find meetings with them or their staff members to tell them about who we are as a community, how we are reflected within their district, and what the issues we care about are. And briefly, I will say that anytime some sort of social policy or public policy concern intersects with religion, that's our little sweet spot. That's the point where we say, is this good or bad for our community? And if we need to chime in with our voice, then we feel it's our responsibility to represent our donors and supporters in that way. We're often chasing bad legislation, trying to stop it. Supporting good legislation, we'll go out and ask people to please co-sign or support a certain piece of legislation. The more the merrier. And the other thing that we do, that specifically the Secular Coalition for America does, is we try to elevate the voice of our 19 member organizations. Some of those organizations are very large, and they don't need us for that purpose, but again, working together. And one of the things we do is we hold monthly meetings for the lobbyists, for the grassroots workers, for the communication specialists, so that we know that we're walking in coordination with one another toward common goals.
Would you talk a little bit to our listeners about how they can be more informed about the Secular Coalition and how they can support your work?
Yes, of course. So the best place would be to visit our website, and that would be at secular.org. On that website, you can look at our issues, and you can also look for our secular agenda for the 117th Congress and Biden administration. Again, that's the secular agenda for the 117th Congress. If you search for that on our website, you'll be able to get a list of our legislative priorities for the coming year. These are the things that we're most likely to work on. You also can sign up for a MailChimp newsletter. We send something out about once a week, and it tries to be informational. It tries to update you on what we are lobbying on. If we've had visits, how did they come about, and what was accomplished, and what our next steps are. Another thing that we are very happy to do is help people visit their Congress members and promote their causes or their issues or their concerns. And that invitation is open to everybody, regardless of political party. We would really love to involve people from all political persuasions, because some legislators will listen to some people more than they will somebody else. And I feel we don't have enough atheists speaking to more conservative, Republican, libertarian legislators.
Debbie Allen is Executive Director of the Secular Coalition for America. Thank you so much for being with us on State of Belief today. Thank you so much, Debbie.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure, really. Thank you.
Andrew Hanauer had no way of knowing, back when the One America movement was founded, just how essential the already important work would quickly become. After all, we are now seeing the horrifying effects of relentless polarizing, othering, and dividing our nation for politics and profit everywhere. The situation has caused many to throw up their hands in frustration and despair. But in keeping with a core foundational principle of bringing small groups of people and local communities together, and then scaling those encounters in remarkable ways, the One America movement is relentlessly focused on its mission and raising up the potential of re-engagement and connection in both sacred and secular settings. Now, with all of that in mind, I am delighted to have Andrew Hanauer, President and CEO of the One America Movement, back with us again. Andy, thanks so much for being with us on State of Belief Radio again.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be with you again.
I am excited to hear more about the work that you're doing with faith communities all across this country.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. I mean, you know, obviously it's been a hard year. Really, in addition to the pandemic, right? I mean, when we talked about polarization being toxic, we used to have to explain what that meant, and now we don't. Now I think people get it.
Yeah.
So you know, we really excited about the work that we're doing in a couple ways. One is bringing faith communities together across divides, political, religious, racial divides, not to sit and talk and debate, you know, politics, but to roll up our sleeves and work, get to work, do things together, do things that matter together,
mm-hmm.
Work in our communities, fight the opioid crisis, rebuild, you know, after the impact of the pandemic. And that's a huge part of what we're going to be doing over the next year as we begin to be able to do things in person again. But the other thing that we're doing that I'm really excited about is we know that these divisions are also, you know, toxic inside congregations, right? And so pastors and rabbis are dealing with how that toxicity comes down from our political system and our media and social media and impacts the people inside their congregations. And so we're really doing a lot to help religious leaders navigate those dynamics. How do you have hard conversations inside your church or your mosque? How do you confront toxic forms of behavior that stem from that inside your congregation?
Yeah. So in what settings do you see this as needing to be addressed most urgently right now?
That's a great question. I think this may be an easy way out in some sense, but I think it's actually all of us, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the reality is that toxic polarization, polarized sort of psychology, brings out things in us that were already there and makes them a lot worse. And in some cases that can lead people to horrifying acts of violence. In other cases, it just makes us a little snarkier, a little more smug in our belief system. It leads to bad decisions. It makes us less likely to have conversations with our neighbors. So the impact is not always symmetrical, but it feeds itself. And so, you know, no matter how big or small, when we allow ourselves to be part of that sort of toxic system, we're really enabling it in all other formats around the country. So what I say a lot is that the most urgent thing that any of us can do is refuse to be part of that system ourselves. Don't allow cable news or social media to reduce complex issues down to neat little packages that make us feel better about ourselves. Don't abandon your neighbors or family or friends because of a litmus test that you've sort of created in your head about what their behavior says about them or what have you, or who they voted for. These are simple things that are difficult. But really, if we start internally, I think we can really start to actually address the problem.
Yeah, I've seen heartbreaking stories of longtime pastors leaving the ministry because they can no longer bridge the political rifts that have emerged in their congregations. That's why your focus on working with houses of worship is so encouraging to me and so necessary.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think to your last question too, if there is one place where we see the most urgent need, it is with these pastors. So we work a lot with pastors from sort of traditionally evangelical backgrounds and denominations or traditions. And you know, look, they went to seminary. They learned all sorts of things at seminary, but a lot of what they're seeing right now are things that they really haven't been prepared for. They don't have training on. And as you've said, very tragically, a lot of them are leaving because it's so toxic and it's so stressful and difficult. And so part of what we're trying to do is just support, those who are in the midst of this, support them with resources and trainings on, How do you navigate these difficult conversations? How do you navigate misinformation or disinformation? How do you deal with a situation in which your congregants seem to be placing their political worldview ahead of their faith? Mm-hmm. And so we want to support those pastors with those kinds of resources and trainings, but also with peer support, with friendship, with fellowship.
Yeah.
Bring them together. Give them people they can talk to who they can say, hey, this is what I saw on Facebook. What did you see? How did you handle that? Yeah. Share best practices.
Yeah.
That's urgent. We need to support these religious leaders in the midst of what we're seeing as a country.
Listen, I have to ask you, the organization's mandate lists engagement with groups as diverse and many would say irreconcilable as the Southern Baptist Convention and Black Lives Matter. How on earth do you do that?
I think, first of all, we get caricatures a lot in our media, right? I mean, a very typical media story is to take the most extreme person in a group, put their most extreme view on display, and then say, gosh, how bad is that, huh? And I think the reality is that most Americans are not there. Most Americans are frustrated. They're exhausted. They're tired of the circus. They have strong political views, for sure, but they want to see society function. They want to see their local government function. They want to have good relationships with their neighbors. They want to help people in their community. Mm-hmm. I think that's true of most people who are, activists in Black Lives Matter. I think it's true of most Southern Baptists. I think it's just mostly true. The first answer to your question is I don't think it's actually as hard as it seems. I think our model is also not built on bringing together the most extreme people in a room at the same time as a starting place, right? We bring communities together, and over time, those communities will have engagement from people who are farther and farther, away from feeling comfortable about engaging across divides. Mm-hmm. That takes time. It takes relational trust. It takes thoughtfulness. It's not something you just stick people in a room and just hope it goes well, mm-hmm. And so it really is long-term work.
Yeah. Andy, would you talk about ways One America Movement is able to convey the threat of toxic polarization and work towards solutions without pointing fingers of blame, which would be a sure way to end any conversation across lines of division?
Yeah, that's a great question. I wrote about this recently. You can always organize unlikely coalitions around shared enemies, right? I mean, after 9/11, Americans were exceptionally united because we had a shared enemy, this terrorist threat. But we also know that that's really dangerous, that if you make other human beings the enemy, that can lead really uncomfortable places. I think social media companies are immensely responsible for some of the things we're seeing right now. I don't believe that the human beings who work at those tech companies should be our enemies or the people that we target with our rhetoric. We have to be better than that. So we're trying to help people see that there's both a system at play here that, as you said, divides us for politics and profit. That's 100% true. Mm-hmm. And we're also challenging people. It'd be easy to say, we're all the victims of the system, but we're also the perpetrators, right? We're also responsible. We also contribute to it. What articles do we click on because of the headline? What books do we buy because we're going to like what it says, about those other people? What people are we not willing to have conversations with who we actually could influence in a way that brings the country together? So we just refuse to take the easy way out and blame certain people without also looking in the mirror. Mm.
It's clear that the silo effect of social media serves to move people further and further away from each other. The physical isolation of the pandemic only made this worse. So what are some ways that you're able to reach people who have self-isolated from the rest of society and are therefore the most impacted by the toxic polarization that you are fighting against?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a really big problem. I think our model is based on the idea that we work with congregations, right? And so the people who are actively involved in religious communities are often less isolated. They're often more connected. But they also have relatives who are more isolated, right? And the people who you're describing often have a grandmother or a sister or a brother who go to church, even if they don't. And so our hope is that by working with the millions and millions of Americans who belong to religious communities, we're also going to have the ability to help them best reach those people who are really more isolated. Mm-hmm. I think that, we also have to remember that we aren't necessarily the best messenger to reach those people. Their relatives might be the best messenger. And so it's not about how do we reach 370 million Americans. It's really about how do we do the work we do within the religious community and empower people in those communities to be effective at helping to stitch this country back together after the isolation and division of especially the past year.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the pandemic, I know the various restrictions must have had a significant impact on the in-person engagements the One America movement is so good at. But I see you also have developed some powerful online training programs, and I'd love to have you talk about some of the ones that you've done as well as what's coming up in the next few weeks, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for noting that. Yeah, we've missed people, and we like people. We like being around people. And so, online events are never for us as good as being out there. But we pivoted during the pandemic to offer some online trainings, and we think they're really interactive and fun. We help people with things like how to talk to your neighbor, how to understand the science behind polarization. We're developing more materials and more things online that people can get involved with on their own time. Doing things on your own, but also having support from our organization as needed. And I think these things are really helpful because they help give people a language for how to understand what they're seeing, right? When you see people acting the way they do on social media, understanding how group norms work, how social pressure works, what the psychology is behind that, it helps you sort of name it and say, oh, okay, I get what's going on here. And not feel so overwhelmed by it. So yes, if people are interested in being on one of those trainings, you can go to our website, oneamericamovement.org, all spelled out, and there'll be a series of opportunities to sign up for free events. If you are in certain geographic areas where we're going to be doing a lot of work, there are going to be a lot of ways to get involved in person. That's true in Pennsylvania, Maryland, Mississippi, Michigan, Ohio, Illinois, Georgia, Utah, Oklahoma, California. So, in a lot of other places as well, there will be opportunities where if you're especially a member of a faith community, we will be doing things in your community, and there'll be events that you can be part of and part of this work. If you are a religious leader who's really looking for support in navigating this really divisive moment, reach out to us through our website, and we will be in touch for sure. And then if you're anybody who just wants to learn more and get a sort of a glimpse for the kind of work that we're doing, there are online events and trainings and conversations that you can be a part of. They're free. And you can just go to our website, oneamericamovement, allspelledout.org, and sign up.
Andrew Hanauer is the president and CEO of the One America Movement, a growing national initiative to counter and heal the toxic polarization that is plaguing our nation. a gifted public speaker and inspiring writer. Andy has been generous with his time on this show. Thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you, and I appreciate the questions and everything that you're doing.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week, one person for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was.